State Skyline Studio.
WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for February the 17th, 2019. Thanks, as always, for tuning in to our weekly look at the world of politics and policy as we go from City Hall to the State House and all the way to the White House. So, time to grab that Sunday paper, get that hot cup of coffee, and we'll do our best to get your week off to a good start. Well, I have to tell you, no snow yet here downtown, but do we really need more snow?
No.
I mean, come on.
Negative. No.
Yeah. I'm done with it.
The weather computer here telling us some light snow at O'Hare. And I guess now is a good time to get this out of the way, at least, or we will be mentioning it throughout the morning. Winter weather advisory. effect in until midnight for Boone, DeKalb, LaSalle, Lee, Ogle, and Winnebago counties. That winter weather advisory in effect now until 6 o'clock tomorrow morning for Lake and McHenry.
That's the Rockford Weather Service that's on the phone.
Yes,
there.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, snow should not be allowed once pitchers and catchers report to spring training.
39 days till opening day?
Yeah, it's just not allowed.
No, it's not. It's not fair. But, you know, I can tell, and Dave appreciate this especially, I can tell there is a sign that, spring is coming because the other day downtown, as I was going past our old stomping ground at Tribune Tower, outside under the kind of the construction area was Johnny Six Note.
Ah, he's emerging from hibernation.
Yeah, unfortunately, he's back with his various six notes that he can play on the saxophone.
Maybe he'll be a seven note for the 2019 year.
You think? So I guess, you know, I missed Tribune Tower. I missed the digs over there, but I won't miss Johnny Six Note. That's for darn sure. The shoulder's getting better, by the way.
That's good.
People been asking. Although I had a lot of like data entry, you know, crunching numbers that I did for a story, and of course, the wisdom of people to put all of the like the number keys for the calculator are at the far right side of the keyboard. So stretch that out a little bit. But everybody's been saying, and I've been wearing the sling on and off. I know I'm supposed to wear it most of the time, but it kind of does get in the way. But people were saying, well, wear the sling, you know, when you're outside, and so people will see that you've got a sling and whatever. People aren't looking.
No.
They're all looking at their phones. I mean, you're looking out for them so that they don't hit you.
Yeah, you know, you'd have to be a defensive driver and now a defensive walker.
I'm serious about that. I'm absolutely serious about that. Whether it's, you know, tourists looking at the GPS because they're lost or whatever. But even, you know, with the offices for the Chicago Tribune and Prudential Plaza, and, you know, it's a busy place. And people are, they're walking downstairs just in their phone. And it's like, please. I mean, here I am. It's my old guy rant, okay?
It's okay.
No, I mean, come on. Unless you're, you know, watching a hockey game or something on your phone.
Then it's excusable, of course.
Yeah. There are certain excuses. Thankfully, I fell asleep after the second period of last night's Blackhawks game.
That was a good time to fall asleep.
Yeah. What happened in the third period?
Lucky goal at the very beginning kind of set the tone. Artemi Panarin was skating in front of the net. It had his back to the shot that was coming from the point. It hit off his stick, bounced, and then went over Cam Ward's shoulder.
Yeah. And then it was downhill from
and
there.
And it was pretty much downhill from there.
That's too bad, because that would have been a nice win. And I read a statistic that, Kane and Taves each had a goal.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the first time.
You're stealing my thunder, but go ahead.
You know what?
That's okay.
You want to go ahead?
No, go ahead.
First time they lost in regulation play with those two scoring a goal since 2013.
Yep, October 9th, to be exact.
Isn't that amazing?
They've scored a goal in the same game, I was reading, also 93 times.
Wow.
So think about that. One time in the last, now what, 6 years?
Well, but 93 times, does that count overtime, though?
No, that's true. That's true.
But still, I mean, that's just... Anyway, they're fun to watch. I'm sorry.
No,
they were fun to watch for two periods last night.
Yeah, they were. The start wasn't exactly great. Coach Collin was not exactly pleased with the way that things started, but they really came back in the second period. And,
right.
There was another late goal, and all the momentum seemed to be on the Blackhawks' side. But then 12 seconds into the third period, there was a goal by Columbus, and that was pretty much the end of the story.
Shuts down the United Center sound real quick. But like I said, they are fun to watch. We've got baseball approaching, and I'm kind of curious about this Cubs channel, the marquee channel. I'm not so sure I want to pay.
Yeah, it's interesting because a lot of people use the argument that, the Cubs have been on cable for so long, the White Sox have been there, the Blackhawks and the Bulls. But that situation is included with whatever package you get from whatever provider you have, your cable company or your satellite company. This is going to be something else. It's going to be sort of its own entity because they're going to have to now figure out what they're going to charge the carriers to carry it.
Right.
And then that cost is going to be inflated, obviously, because the carriers want to make a little money off of you. And people will have to make a choice. I mean, whether they want to spend 10, 15, whatever it is going to be per month or whatever to buy this network. And I don't know.
And
I mean, I don't have a good sense of what people are thinking.
And remember, too, that's like our home residential rate.
Mm-hmm.
What about
For bars. Yeah.
And paying the commercial freight on this.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. It'll really be interesting to see if the Cubs have a down year. A lot of people are predicting that. I mean, I don't really see it yet.
I don't know.
It's hard to get that feeling this early when we haven't even played a spring training game yet. But, I mean, if they do struggle and they've had some bad publicity over the last couple of weeks, what that will do, if that will affect how many people would actually sign up for this.
Well, and I'm going to say it, too. I'm not exactly excited about doing anything to put any money in the pockets of Sinclair Broadcasting.
Mm-hmm.
I
hear you.
Just kind of the irony of the Cubs trying to clean up the Joe Ricketts email mess. And, obviously, Todd Ricketts, he's finance chairman of the Republican National Committee. Another Rickett is governor of Nebraska. Laura's kind of the Democrat mm-hmm. in the crowd. But we all know about Sinclair Broadcasting. And, when you have to have Theo out there giving assurances that, well, Sinclair runs the tennis network. There's no, right-wing agenda that you hear in the tennis network. Sorry, I don't watch the tennis network.
Yeah, me neither.
I don't know that anybody, I mean, nothing against tennis, mm-hmm. mind you, but it's not, but I'm very perturbed by that. And when Sinclair was looking at buying this place
mm-hmm.
and WGN Television and all the rest of them, I mean, I was doing some soul searching because of, I'm very familiar with Sinclair Broadcasting. I know several people that have worked at Sinclair Broadcasting. Everybody saw that famous viral video of anchors being forced to read script. That ain't an operation I want to be part of. And that's not journalism. And truly, I'm somewhat still amazed that the FCC kiboshed the Tribune acquisition, given how they were playing up to the new administration of Donald Trump. But and the fact that to get around certain rules, the Sinclair was going to transfer ownership of various stations to a buddy of the owner of Sinclair, who was a car dealer.
Yeah.
What does that say? that, you know, there's your kind of reputable company you want to hook up with.
Yeah.
So yeah, so I'm perfectly happy to sit on the patio with the transistor radio and listen to the Cubs games on the radio,
just like the old days.
Yeah,
I can see you there with a little earpiece in the ear.
Beverage
of choice.
Country Time lemonade.
Yeah, yes. And the grill mm-hmm. fired up.
And the grill fired up.
I actually had, and I know I still have it somewhere, I had a transistor that had a, you could adjust it for a delay to for so you could match it up with the TV.
Nice.
Picture and stuff. So I can live with that, you know. I'll listen to my Sox here on GN. I'll listen to the Cubs. But I think as far as paying to watch them on TV, ain't going to happen.
Yeah, I think kind of politics aside, I think that's going to be the biggest thing for the viewer, is to decide whether or not they want to fork out the money for it.
Right. And we all know what the experience has been in with L.A. with the Dodgers.
Yeah, L.A. did it. And L.A.'s problem, and also in San Diego, the problem was that there were carriers that didn't want to pay the fee.
Right.
So they didn't add the channel, and you get,
you didn't even have the option.
Yeah, you get like 60% of your viewing area that can't see the games.
Right. Well, it'll be an interesting experiment that we'll be watching and seeing what happens. But
I have a news item.
Yes,
it's snowing in downtown Chicago.
Yeah, I just looked
now.
Out the window. I saw that too.
Okay, here we go. Here we go.
Rumble, rumble, rumble. Mutiny, mutiny.
Garuff, garuff, garuff.
Oh, thank you for that news update.
You're quite welcome.
Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news. Andy, of course, has the latest sports. Producer Casero is fielding your calls at 312-981-7200. You can also text us at that number, 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin, on Twitter at @SundaySpin. And engineer Brett is here to push all of my buttons. Remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNRadio.com. You can also get our podcast there and also at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin on this snowy morning in Chicago. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio. Up ahead on your Sunday Spin, after we get a new update on the news and sports at 7:30, we'll speak to my Chicago Tribune colleague, John Byrne. John covers City Hall and part of a political team, and we'll get the latest from him on the mayor's race as Election Day nears. We'll have more news and sports at the top of the hour, and then we'll speak to a good friend of the program, author and educator Michael Golden. He's written a piece on Chicago's history of racial problems and how the next mayor, whoever it is, must deal with that issue. We'll get a final check of the news and sports and weather at 8:30, and then we'll speak to James Sweeney. He's the president and business manager of the powerful International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 150, based in Countryside. And we'll talk to him about the problems with the state's infrastructure and the need for a public works program in the state. That's all up ahead. We're going to launch our spin through national politics, and of course, we begin with the president signing the congressional agreement on government funding, including border security, but not giving the president all of that $5.7 billion that he wants for a border wall, only getting about a third of it. So as a result, the president declared border security a national emergency and then flew to Florida.
I'm going to be signing a national emergency, and it's been signed many times before. It's been signed by other presidents. From 1977 or so, it gave the presidents the power. There's rarely been a problem. They sign it. Nobody cares. I guess they weren't very exciting, but nobody cares. They sign it for far less important things in some cases, in many cases. We're talking about an invasion of our country with drugs, with human traffickers, with all types of criminals and gangs.
So that is the president's rationale for declaring a national emergency. Even before Trump made that emergency declaration, Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer of New York warned Trump that he was making a big mistake.
If President Trump decides to go forward with a disaster declaration, he'll be making a tremendous mistake. Declaring a national emergency would be a lawless act, a gross abuse of the power of the presidency and a desperate attempt to distract from the fact that President Trump broke his core promise to have Mexico pay for the wall. It would be another demonstration of President Trump's naked contempt for the rule of law and congressional authority.
Now, on the Senate floor, Schumer vowed that there would be a legal fight over the president trying to shift money from the Pentagon and other areas to make up for the billions of dollars that Democrats in Congress wouldn't give him.
President Trump couldn't convince Mexico. He couldn't convince the American people. He couldn't convince their elected representatives to pay for his ineffective and expensive wall. So now he's trying an end run around Congress in a desperate attempt to put taxpayers on the hook for it. Make no mistake, Congress will defend our constitutional authorities in every way that we can.
On NBC's Meet the Press Daily, Illinois Congresswoman Sherry Bustos, the head of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, Bustos said that Trump is trying to fulfill what she called a bumper sticker promise on the wall.
We came together, Democrats, Republicans, House members, senators, and came up with a real negotiated idea here. It's something that we haven't seen in Washington for a little while. But it was when you negotiate and you come up with a compromise, it means we don't get everything we want. Democrats didn't, Republicans didn't, the president's not going to. But this is really how democracy should work, and I'm proud of that process. Yeah. What the president's trying to do now, he needs to fulfill his bumper sticker of build the wall. And so he is declaring a national emergency in order to do that.
That's Illinois Democratic Congresswoman Sherry Bustos. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune, here in the Allstate Skyline studio and joined by my good friend, colleague, John Byrne from the Tribune, a political reporter, part of the political team covering City Hall, definitely covering the mayor's race, which...
Is there a mayor's race? What?
Yeah, what? That's all you've been doing.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, I'm surprised. Thank you for coming in, actually, because I'm kind of surprised to catch you on a free moment.
Drinking out of the fire hydrant is how you're referring to it.
Well, I mean... I'm surprised there isn't actually a mayoral forum going on right now.
I think there is. We're missing three forums at this moment.
Yes, exactly. In three different locations.
Exactly. Three different interest groups at their forums right now.
I mean, there's been no shortage of that.
No, for sure.
At a certain point, the news value diminishes very quickly.
You are telling me.
Well, because everybody reverts their talking points and their attack points kind of thing.
Right.
There's been some polling out there, and I think the easiest way, as I try to explain it, is, and I've talked to some very well-respected pollsters. I've gotten to know many during the years nationally, and they tell me you can't poll this thing.
Really?
There's too many candidates, 14 candidates, that from... the indicative polling that we've seen, when you're talking about a lead is 14 to 16%.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Which means in a sample size that you call, a shift of 10 people can turn somebody into, quote, a front runner.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't call anybody a front runner in this. Right. I don't think you can poll it.
20% undecideds or whatever.
I mean, truly, I've said if there's a front runner, it's undecided.
Right.
Right. And it comes down to, and John's co-authored a story in today's Tribune with Greg Pratt about, where we stand in the race right now. And, it's always that that kind of cliche, it all depends on turnout.
Right.
But this really does depend.
Ground game.
But this is really what's going to determine it.
Yeah. Yeah, and you've got the different candidates playing up their strengths, and one of Tony Preckwinkle's strengths, clearly, is that she's got some union support from the likes of SEIU, which is backing her very strongly, and they can put people on the street. SEIU can and will put people on the street, and they'll go door to door, and they'll get people to the polls, and that could be a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, CTU is a bit, but that's a bit more kind of, I think there's more divisions among the rank and file there.
That's the impression that I've gotten. You don't have Karen Lewis, who was sort of the galvanizing hold the different factions of CTU together. She's not there anymore. And so, yeah, I think there might be more going their own way within the ranks of CTU.
And, you know, obviously as part of a ground game, there's money involved, too. I mean, money, organization, it all goes together.
Right.
And, you know, we've seen Bill Daley, you know, just leading the money ranks at
7.2. He's up over 7.2 now, and we're hearing talk of more big checks possibly coming his way very shortly, and you total up the second and third best-funded candidates, and they don't even equal 7.2. So
right.
He's pulled ahead there.
Well, and then he's got the $1 million from Ken Griffin.
Right.
Griffin, of course, the person going down in history as the largest donor to a candidate nationally was when he gave $20 million to Bruce Rauner, part of the $36 million that Griffin gave to Rauner over his campaigns, the head of Citadel, founder of the hedge fund. And of course, you know, with that comes the natural attacks that
he'll be Griffin's mayor. You're hearing that from several of the other mayoral candidates now.
And that he's a Rauner.
Right, that he's a Rauner guy. Susanna Mendoza, state comptroller, who of course loves to mix it up with the Rauner boogeyman, was quick to
well,
jump.
Well,
yeah,
on resurrected. That. It's kind of like, you know, when we saw her commercials, and it was largely about, you know, her being, you know, attacking Rauner as in her position as state comptroller. And I'm going, well, what kind of resonance does that bring to a race for mayor?
Right.
But then Griffin kind of opens that door with a $1 million check.
Yeah. Yeah, she Bill was happy to get the $1 million, and Susanna was probably the second happiest candidate, because it puts Rauner right back in this race.
And you know, and obviously, you know, Daley has to answer for that, mm-hmm. that issue. And of course, I mean, the one thing about that Griffin check is we've been waiting as reporters, kind of, where is the business community
mm-hmm.
in this race?
Yeah. And you're seeing some of them fall into line behind Daley, and he, you know, as he's shown to be a strong candidate, some of these polls are putting him in first or second place, and so some of these the business interests that have been sitting on the sidelines are starting to come into play here a little bit in the final days.
And you know, obviously, people not getting in early, wanting to hedge their bets to see if anybody could emerge here.
Right.
But as you get closer to election time, people starting to weigh in a little bit. I mean, I had Bill Daley on the show a couple weeks ago, and it still kind of strikes me as, you know, given the tenure of his father, given the tenure of his brother, you know, the issue of Daley fatigue.
Right. It's been amazing to see when he got into the race, lots of people said, ah, Chicago's not going to elect another Daley. Come
right.
on. And yet here we are. And his money has a lot to do with that. He's had a bunch of ads, and you can see him getting a little bit, you know, he goes to these forum after forum. He sits out some of them and has been accused of running a Rose Garden type campaign by some of the other candidates who want the opportunity to poke him in the eye about his Daley-ness. But he goes to these forums and you see him, he's just getting fed up. He's getting fed up with answering these questions. You know, you've got the likes of John Kozlar sitting there just teeing off on him. You know, this guy from Bridgeport, yeah. Kozlar, just teeing off on him. And Daley's just like, you can see the smoke coming out of his ears. He's like, well, and he did get off a good line at maybe it was the Sun-Times forum where he said, look, are you calling the people of Chicago idiots? They voted for my brother 6 times. So you want to say that they were idiotic to do that? Well, that's on you, you know? And so he's saying, you know, trust in the voters to know what's right.
Well, there's no doubt, I think, that the fact of the TV advertising has, mm-hmm. has been significant.
Yeah.
It is a significant factor for him. And I mentioned when I was off while my shoulder was recovering, I got to see more than my fair share of television. And he was everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, in your story today, we've got him at like $1.9 million on broadcast television. So over 2 million, I think, on if you include cable.
Yeah. Thank you for your help on that.
Thank you
so much.
Yeah. Well, my shoulder is paying for it.
I'm so sorry. Yeah.
But that's okay. But, you know, that's a lot of TV.
Yeah.
And yes, Chicago market's expensive, which, you know, that's kind of the TV factor does kind of sort out the candidates mm-hmm. and their fundraising ability. Cable, of course, is less expensive, and everybody's can get a bite of the cable buys. But you know, $2 million is that's a big chunk of change.
It is,
and you know, part of me too, as I see, you know, we start seeing some of the business community going to daily. In as much as there's that daily fatigue thing, I see two factors here, and one is kind of a stability factor. With a daily, you kind of know what you're going to get.
Yep.
Versus, you know, I mean, it's like we talk about the Democratic Party and the establishment wing and the progressive wing and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And we can see that. Those kind of divisions in this field exist.
You sure can. Daily, he wants to make the runoff and then say to the people of Chicago, pick, who do you trust? Who do you trust? Who do you feel safe with here? No matter who he's up against, he's going to make that case. I'm the guy who's not going to run the airplane into the cliff.
Well, it's like you see with, you know, many other candidates, like we saw in the Democratic primary for governor, every one of them claiming to be a progressive.
Right.
I don't know that I've heard Bill Daley say the term progressive.
Right. And he's talked about the fact that, you know, well progressive just become, it's just this term. And you hear Daley, he's talking, he's not claiming to be progressive, but you've heard him talk about why people are saying progressive. And it's just become a term, as Democrats are afraid to use the term liberal now, progressives just become a thing that people kind of throw out. And you're right, he has not tried to claim that mantle.
I haven't heard him call himself a liberal either.
Yeah, no, none of the above.
We're speaking with John Byrne, my Tribune colleague from the City Hall political team. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune, joined by my Tribune colleague, John Byrne, who is part of the City Hall political team as we kind of go through the mayoral race. I mean, as I said, people, I know they ask you, they ask me, they ask all of us, so who's it going to be?
Right.
And one thing I always joke is that since I also do work with WGN, you know, Tom Skilling gets a lot of money to make predictions. I don't get Tom Skilling money, so yeah. I don't make predictions. But I mean, this is what's so hard about this is because with the percentage margins here, you know, like 14, 16 could be in the runoff,
right.
That it's just you can't really call anybody a front runner.
No way. I when people ask me, and they ask me 20 times a day, I was at a family party last night, right? So
sure.
There are like 10 combinations
right.
here that I would absolutely not be shocked by. I would not be at all shocked by about 10 different combos.
No, it's like I want to buy an Exacta box here, you know,
yeah.
because
yeah.
At the track.
Right.
There are any number of potential combinations.
I'll take the field. Just give me the field.
Yeah, right. Well, and I mean, I've been intrigued, and you've been part of this coverage too, about Amira Enya.
Mm.
And, you know, kind of came out of the blocks as like this progressive pop phenom.
Yeah.
And, you know,
Chance the Rapper.
And Kanye.
Yeah.
And then, you're covering an event where, you know, they were sending buses for early voting to campuses and having a big rally, and Chance was supposed to be there, and what happened?
Well, Chance was there in the sense that there was a large portable speaker blasting Chance's music out of it at Daley Plaza, but otherwise he was not there. Amara said that they had done an event with supporters the night before that ran late, and she knew that he wouldn't come. And then the buses pulled into Daley Plaza, and there were probably about 40 people. It was a small enough rally that I didn't have to estimate the number.
You could count.
I counted them one by one because you don't want to be underrepresenting people here at these things, and I rounded up to 40. And you know, she says, well, look, this is early. We're going to be going to campuses. She says that in the next few days, she's going to start having events on campuses with Chance, and that they hope to up the energy level at those. But it did raise some questions about, you know, this was seen as sort of her trump card. She's got Chance the Rapper. She can get these college-age students who maybe weren't going to vote for anybody. And if she can get those people to the polls in a race where 12%, you're sniffing the runoff.
Right.
Then, hey, she's got something here, you know? But you've got to have people on those campuses, and maybe she does. You've got to have that infrastructure.
Well, right. And then here again, that's the ground game.
Right.
And this is not somebody that has shown evidence of a ground game.
Right. And she ran for mayor last time, but you don't see a lot of that, not a lot of aldermen getting behind her, a lot of the of union support of the type where you could have troops. I don't know where that's coming from for her.
We've got a call from Ron. Ron, welcome as always to the Sunday Spin.
Hey, good morning, and Ms. Turner, really enjoy your work.
Good morning,
and
thanks.
It was very strange and ironic, Rick, when Bill Daley was on your show, and he really portrayed himself as being somewhat of an outsider. He called the other candidates bureaucrats. Very strange coming from a Daley. But to ask you guys, you mentioned Mario Andy, but if there's another person that, for the various reasons y'all mentioned, maybe Daley and Preck, we go to front runners. It could be someone else in this next few days that I'll at least make it interesting, maybe, which is to say, probably giving them a run. I think Preckwick was still going to have some trouble relative to the Burke incident. But maybe just now. I don't know if this who it would be, but just want to ask you guys. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ron. I don't know. Is there a wild card candidate?
I'm telling you, there are like four wild card candidates, and I don't even know if you can call anyone a wild card candidate because, like you said, that's assuming that there are actual front runners,
right?
And lots of polls say, oh, maybe it's Preckwinkle, maybe it's Daley in front, but there are like five other candidates within the margin of error, and like you said, you talk to 10 people, and you're throwing it all off with 14 candidates. So I think that there are lots of people who could make the runoff. I talked to Gary McCarthy the other day, and he said, look, you're talking about 20% undecided. Those 20%, they're not breaking for Preckwinkle. They're not going to break for Daley, is his argument. His argument is, if you're out there and you're undecided, you're thinking about the rest of the field. If you are going to back Preckwinkle, he says, McCarthy says, you've made that decision. You're not undecided. So his theory is that Preckwinkle's at her ceiling. Daley's at his ceiling because they're known entities, and that the rest of them can try to grab as much of this 20%, and any of them could vault ahead of a Preckwinkle or a Daley.
Well, and we should note, too, and we were talking about TV ad spending, that McCarthy is somewhat unique in that he has not bought any broadcast TV time. All of his commercials have all been on cable. And, of course, you know, when you're playing with a limited amount of funds, that's probably the smart play to make.
Yeah.
But, you know, there is that visibility you get from the broadcast TV, too.
For sure.
You know, you look at Vallis here, you look at... I did note, and I want to make a mention of this, is, you know, obviously the Tribune endorsed Daley, the editorial board, and that's separate from the work that we do
separate.
As reporters. There
separate.
It is absolutely separate. Sun-Times endorsed Lightfoot. And I thought it was interesting, actually, their endorsement, because being obviously owned by unions, that they would go with union-supported candidate like Preckwinkle or, you know, in some cases Mendoza, that kind of thing. So I thought it was kind of an interesting, like, outside-the-box endorsement. But I was very dismayed that Channel 5 and Telemundo did a poll, again, with showing, you know, these this 14%
cluster. Cluster of candidates.
And they post on the Internet a story, the Sun Times does, that Lori Lightfoot's in the top five. And that's the lead of the story. And by percentage basis, she's fourth out of five.
Right.
But she's their endorsed candidate.
Yeah.
And that's the story that gets posted.
Yeah, it was a bit arbitrary, it seemed.
Well, and I posted on the Internet. And look, we have good friends that work at the Sun-Times, and this is
nothing. Some of us have family members.
Yes, indeed. Full disclosure, yes. But that just was just amazing to me because of, I said on Twitter, I said, that's not journalism, that's boosterism.
Right, I saw that. It was a head scratcher for sure that was the angle they took on that.
We can do better than that. We can do better than that. John Byrne, my colleague at the Chicago Tribune, doing a great job.
Thanks,
and
Rick.
You know, we'd like to say that, you know, the clock's getting closer to election, except we know there's going to be a runoff. So, yeah. You know, that's just the first hurdle.
And we have to see how long it takes before we know who's in the runoff.
Well, exactly. And I think that's...
We could go to court. We could see somebody go to court and say, hey, I want a recount because I think the margin's so slim here, yeah. You know?
See, you had to go ahead and say that. John, thank you so much for joining
me this
morning.
Now, the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Welcome to your second hour of the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Skyline studio, joined by my good friend Michael Golden, author, educator. He's author of the book Unlock Congress. But he's also authored a new piece that's being posted online. And in fact, we'll have a link to it with along with this interview on the WGNRadio.com website. But he wrote a piece about Chicago's history of segregation and racial strife and how what's really changed. And Michael, welcome.
Hey Rick, it's great to be here.
And you know, race is part of the city's history. It's part of a proud point of diversity, but it's also a sad point in how the city remains probably the most segregated major city in the country.
Yeah, and there are measurements in this article versus other cities, and we pretty much come out on top. There's a few different measurements, but...
A place we don't want to be.
No, of course not. And look, you and I have known each other a while. I've been involved in a couple of mayoral races, so I've gotten to know the city a lot better, I think, than most people who aren't in politics. But not until really recently did I learn a lot more about this. And... Natalie Moore is quoted in the article. She wrote the book called The South Side, and she's an excellent reporter on WBEZ, and that's her beat, The South Side, where she grew up in Chatham. And she talks about just how much those neighborhoods changed, but how many awesome, wonderful middle-class black families there were like hers that they have vibrant communities. They're wonderful in so many ways, and we don't really see it. You know, I mean, on the TV.
Chatham's a great community.
Absolutely. But the article goes into how this started a long, long time ago. Obviously, it goes all the way back to the Great Migration and blacks escaping Jim Crow up to the north to what they thought, and it was in some ways what they thought was going to be an escape from Jim Crow. But there are a lot of housing practices for decades. First of all, federal policies, the Homeowners Loan Corporation, they started this in terms of basically shutting African Americans out, even if they had the resources to live in a place they wanted to live. There were actual policies, and Chicago, applied it in one of the most draconian fashions. You know, there was a narrow sort of lane called the Black Belt going through the South Side, and it took a while for that to expand. And once it did, once in 1968 the Fair Housing Act was passed, right? Congress passed and said you can't do this anymore. This is discriminatory.
1968.
Right. as part of this whole Civil Rights Act. But even after that, they were flouting the rules and coming up with, you know, redlining. There's different
redlining
ways.
Redlining discriminatory practices.
Right. There were ways of saying that, oh, this neighborhood, there's too many X in it, and so they don't have the ability to pay back the loans, even though they might. Or in a lot of cases, they did have the resources. They all things being equal, they would have gotten a mortgage loan. So, I mean, these practices still go on, and I'll tell you something.
Well, remember the covenants too.
Racial covenants. And when I realized just last week, because a friend of mine is on the Chicago Realtors Association, and that was the Chicago Real Estate Board that, almost 100 years ago, applied a lot of these things. And just recently, just last year, the CEO, who is a minority, a person of color, who's the CEO, said in public and sent a letter of apology to all minorities that had been shut out of this process and out of a better life, and said that they were complicit. I mean, it was pretty comprehensive. And I wrote in this article that's a good step, and they set up a committee to, you know, talk about a diversity committee to talk about these issues, report them, and eliminate them if they're happening, right? But the city has to, in my opinion, face up to this. People don't like to talk about segregation and race, right? It's a very, believe me, it's a very touchy subject, even sitting here right now, and certainly writing a long article about the history of it, learning from others, myself, what's going on, and people tiptoe around it. But I think that until a mayor, a city council too, but a mayor starts talking about this a lot and doing things to resource a lot of neighborhoods where there's great things going on in the West and the South Side. Awesome people, awesome Chicago residents who are doing great things, but it's not a fair playing field.
We're speaking with Michael Golden, author and educator. He's written Unlock Congress, also the author of a new piece about Chicago and its history of segregation and where do we go in the future. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, joined here in the Allstate Skyline studio by Michael Golden, my good friend. He's the author of Unlock Congress and also just authored a piece about Chicago's history and the role of segregation in that history. And now moving forward as we get closer to electing a new mayor. And, you know, you touched on what the realtors did and appointing like a board to review practices and diversity.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm almost wondering if it shouldn't be standard operating procedure today that you almost, you know, mayor, governor, whatever, is have a chief diversity officer.
I think that's a good idea, or at least someone in the mayor's office who's holding those kinds of positions or entities accountable, right, that have been responsible. And I give the Chicago realtors a lot of credit for what they did. I mean, it was a full mea culpa, and they had this event, and they had a whole discussion about it. But but here's the thing. You know, look, there are statistics upon statistics, and I put some of them in there about how racially segregated Chicago has hurt races in Chicago and in a concentration of neighborhoods. Of all the ninth graders who start CPS, after 10 years, only 6% of, let me say that again, 14 out of 100 who go into Chicago high schools get a college degree after 10 years that are a minority, and 6% of that are black men. And by the way, Mayor Emanuel's done a number of good things in this area. I just think it needs to be put on steroids in a way. And so to your point about the city-wide, what this does, this is, I thought, really interesting. The Urban Institute did a study, okay? And they basically compared Chicago versus 100 other largest metropolitan areas in the country, okay? And they came up with a median, right? And Chicago was obviously near the top of cities that were segregated. And what they found was that this costs our city $4 billion in income and more than 80,000 college degrees a year, the level of segregation we're at. And then they took it and said, well, what if back in the last census, 2010, we could have made Chicago at the median level of this segregation scale, just the median level, what would it have done for the city? We would have... if we had reduced segregation back to that medium, home values would have increased by $6 billion, and Chicago would have saved more than $280 million that we spend in policing incarceration. And by the way, the Urban Institute, the reason that they did this study, and they say it right in the study, is because the morality has not carried us there so far, that a lot of Chicagoans think of it through this morality lens, and I believe it should be looked at, but they looked at it and said, let's grab their attention because this is hurting the entire city. If you're not, if your heartstrings are not pulled by wanting a more level playing field just on a human level in Chicago, then think about it citywide. Think of how much greater we could be.
And look at the economics of it.
Absolutely.
Because
that's what they did.
And you're paying for it.
Absolutely. In ways you don't even see every day.
Right. But, you know, regardless of who's mayor, I mean, look, your piece is extensive, and it talks, you know, about a history of this city, you know, almost from DuSable, really, and where race has fit in and where the city hasn't been helpful. Now you have an open mayoral seat. I mean, these are problems that are endemic makes it sound like you can't fix it.
Ingrained,
right, and sclerotic. I like
yes,
to use that term.
Right,
and really, regardless of who's mayor, you can start taking steps. But this is a process that is going to have to be an evolutionary process.
Yes, no, this there's no question that you can't. This is a century in the making, more than that, and you can't obviously fix it in 4 years. But you can start, and you can do a lot of things that are a lot more visible as mayor. In the last chapter of her book, of Natalie Moore's book, The South Side, she went outside Chicago and across Chicago and learned about a number of solutions. I really recommend this book. But there are things that the city and the mayor can do that don't cost a fortune. Some of it's visibility, some of it's organization, right? Some of it's how City Hall and the police department connect with communities. Look, all the mayoral candidates, right, have talked about restoring trust with the Chicago Police Department. And, you know, it sounds cliche at this point. It is incredibly important. And I really believe that takes leadership from the top. That relationship is severely damaged. And I think that there's going to have to be visible types of events and steps taken to start rebuilding that trust a little bit.
But there again, that's going to be a lengthy process. And you know, just because of recent events, that's going to be a lengthy process to try to restore that kind of sense of community and connection.
And there's no question. We're talking about a consent decree. I mean, we're talking about the Justice Department and a consent decree. And that's a tricky area, too. There's a lot of reasons why that trust has been broken over many years, and especially, I'd say, probably the last 10 years, and especially the last 5-6 years, but you have to start somewhere. And I do believe that leadership comes from the top, and I don't just mean the head of the superintendent of the police department. You know, in this city, when it comes to the schools, when it comes to the police department, and a whole range of other entities, but particularly those two, the mayor is accountable.
Well, and you know, you touch on this piece too, and you mention about there's all kinds of organizations in the South and West Side that are working to improve the lives.
Excellent
work. But are they being coordinated?
Right. That's.
I mean, that's the question I kind of have. Where like somebody who would be a chief diversity officer could like work to help coordinate services and activities and all that kind of thing.
That's what I was talking about when I said organization. There's a way that the city can be, City Hall can be a touch point more so, and help all those great stories get organized and augment each other, right? And I think that look, this has been a long mayoral race. And candidates have talked about a lot of issues, obviously. But As I wrote it toward the end of this article, I think people, as they're thinking about who they're going to choose next week in 9 days, should think about that and check out all the candidates and understand that it's not just about a city that's segregated and the haves and have-nots. It's about the whole city and our reputation and economically what we want to become. And which candidates have really talked about that? Which candidates have talked about it and then have solutions? And I'm just saying,
right.
Voters, I hope. I am not, I hope that they'll take this into consideration because, as I said, the title of it was A City Still Segregated, and the subhead of the article was Chicago's Epic History Still Its Biggest Obstacle. And I actually quoted James Baldwin. I'll screw it up here. But basically, he flips something and says, not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing that is I already screwed it up. Right, he basically flipped it and is saying, if you don't face up to the truth, if you don't face up to what's happened and what the consequences have been, who's been responsible, get all the ugly truth out from under the carpet, you cannot change.
Right
And I think that comes from the top. That comes from our government. That comes from the leader of our government.
Those who fail to acknowledge history are condemned to repeat it.
Or at least rhyme it.
Michael Golden, author, educator, author of the book Unlock Congress, author of Peace on Chicago, The History of Segregation, that you can find at WGNRadio.com. You can find it along with this interview on our website. Michael, thank you so much for joining me.
It's a pleasure. First time we haven't talked about Congress probably in 2 years. Thanks, Rick.
Not much to talk about these days.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good snowy Sunday morning. I'm Rick Pearson. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm here in the Allstate Show Skyline Studio. I still can't get over that showcase studio. I miss it sometimes. The Allstate Skyline Studio. And joining me here in studio is James Sweeney. He is the president and business manager for International Union of Operating Engineers Local 150. Jim, thanks so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you for having me.
We need to move that microphone there so people can hear you. I thought of wanting to talk to you after what we saw with the incident on North Lakeshore Drive and the bridge issue there. We've talked a lot on this program for years about the need for an infrastructure program in this state. And obviously, people love talking about it. But it's been a decade since we had one.
It's been a decade since we had a capital bill.
Yeah.
But within that capital bill, we didn't have nearly enough money for our infrastructure. Infrastructure in regards to roads and bridges and rail. A capital bill encompasses schools and universities and airports.
Everything. That's
what we need
a
in the state, and we've said this to anyone that'll listen, is we need a transit act to rebuild our transportation infrastructure, which is critically important to our economy. We are a logistics-based economy now in this part of the country. And you see it if you drive down I-55 and look off and you see warehouses as far as the eye can see. And all those jobs that go.
And you don't have to go that far. Just look at Bolingbrook, for example, and all of the.
If you pay attention even closer into the city, you're starting to see that now being done closer as we ask, the Amazons of the world want on-time, same-day delivery. They have to build these facilities even closer. All of that relies on infrastructure. Roads and bridges.
And frankly, that's always been our hallmark.
Yes, and it's been our economic advantage. We have 7 major Class 1 rail carriers that all intersect here, the only place it happens in the United States.
And, when the state and voters approved the lockbox, the transportation lockbox amendment.
Absolutely.
And people saw that as a good first step to finally, make sure that funds related to transportation are used for transportation purposes.
We were behind that that initiative. We funded the advertisement and the campaign that went on, us and others in the industry, directed by our local. And I can tell you, the focus groups and everything we did led up to that showed that the public did not have an appetite for a gas tax increase when you asked them. But when you asked them, but if that money went into a lockbox and couldn't be diverted by politicians, Would you be for it then? And the numbers flipped from 30-70 against to 70-34.
So, in essence, is that almost like a first phase? Because
that was the first step that we knew we had to make to get to the point of then getting an administration that would listen to us about infrastructure. And we believe we have that right now.
Because, you know, obviously in the past 4 years with the Rauner administration, I mean, he talked about infrastructure, but there was never any action that went with it. And it was like, well, public-private partnership and that kind of thing, and nothing progressed.
Listen, public-private partnerships have a place in infrastructure investment, but they're going to cherry-pick the very best, which will bring back the best return for their investors. That's not the case with infrastructure. It's no different than the electrification of America. We put poles and electric out to the rural areas of this country where it made no sense economically. That's the same way you need to look at your roads and bridges. Okay, it's the common good. It's for the Commonwealth. We have to make the investment now. I put it the equivalent of, you know, you inherit your grandmother's house and she gives it to you in beautiful shape. And then over the next 20 years, you put nothing into it. And then finally, when the bathtub falls down into the living room, and you sit there and you go, how did this happen? How did this happen? Well, that's what we've done to our roads and our bridges. And this is just roads and bridges. I don't even want to get into the rest of the infrastructure. Remember, we have water issues in this city and around the country with lead. And not only the lead. We have water mains that we still dig up, our crews in this city, that are made of wood. I have one in my office, sitting up on my shelf.
It's not like, I mean, I appreciate the story about Grandma's house and the bathtub falls doing that. How did it happen? The thing is, we know what's happening, and nothing is happening.
You know,
right?
Nothing's happening because the minute people want to talk about a tax increase, it became political. It became political for over the last 4 years. You know, we saw Rauner. You know, and there's a lot of similarities between the rhetoric you heard from Rauner about infrastructure that you hear now from Trump, and nothing is going to happen. I'm very probably critical at the federal level. I don't think we'll see movement until we see administration change. But we can make the change here now in Illinois, and we need to do it immediately. The bridge over I-80 is a great example of a bridge that not only will affect us locally, but will affect the national economy. I-80 is the major east-west road for our commerce across this country. And that bridge, just that one bridge, which was by IDOT, found to be in a condition of intolerability, which is, if you look, I think somewhere on the spectrum of criminal. They admit themselves that they're going to now make a $5 million repair this spring, try to make a $5 million repair on a bridge that needs to be replaced that cost $1 billion. They're going to replace the rockers. They're going to replace 1,000 rockers, which are these devices that it sits on. The bridge collapse in Indiana of I-65 that occurred and caused a 3-month closure of I-65, which is the equivalent of our I-80, and a 3-hour diversion, and cost 12 lives directly accounted to that diversion. One rocker was bad on that bridge.
We should be scared.
Absolutely scared. This is not fear mongering. This is reality. That bridge on that we're looking at right now, from this seat, I can see it on Outer Lakeshore Drive, was built in 1986 and wasn't maintained properly. That's how that occurred. And there's other piers that are in just as bad a shape that have been shored up with this lagging. You know, what we're doing is we're basically just, you know, if your deck collapsed and you jacked it up with your floor jack and then you stuffed wood underneath, that's what we're doing right now. We're acting like a third world country.
Band-aids. We're speaking with James Sweeney, president and business manager of International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 150. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, joined here in the studio by James Sweeney, president and business manager of the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 150, the powerful IUOE, Local 150. We're talking about capital repair and construction. We're talking about the infrastructure. And as I said, start this. Everybody loves to talk about it. Nobody wants to talk about how to pay for it.
Yes, and we've got to get off of that that fear. I mean, we've created the lockbox. It's a constitutional amendment that passed by a supermajority of Illinoisans. It's in place. That money can only be used now for roads and bridges. The price of a gallon of gas adjusted for inflation, from when I was in high school, okay, this would be 1974, the price of gas was, I think, a 38 and a half cents a gallon. The adjusted price of that gallon of gas today, without taxes, is $2.64. We're paying gas is cheaper now than when I was in high school. And we don't want to put 20 cents or 25 cents onto that, which fluctuates some weeks. You'll see it move that much in a week to pay for our roads and our bridges. And the repairs we make to our cars this spring, as this frost comes out of the ground, we have hell to pay as a state.
We're seeing it already.
You haven't seen it. It doesn't happen until that thaw comes. And that's when we're going to be paying the price.
So what are you sensing down in Springfield? Because, again, you know, we hear people talking about it. I think there's a greater realization that they got to do something.
It's definitely going to be bipartisan. Both leadership on the minority side and the majority side know that we need to do this. They've agreed not to make this a partisan issue. It can be done, and it can be done quickly. And it needs to be done quickly because if we passed it next week, we wouldn't see the results for another year, right? And what I mean results is we have to first engineer these projects. Most of the projects that need to be replaced in the states aren't even engineered. We've let IDOT be decimated over a decade.
They're not what used to be known as shovel-ready.
Shovel-ready doesn't exist. They're not on the shelves anymore because we haven't made the investment in the engineering portion of this as well.
And then we got to sell bonds and go through
that kind of
process.
Right.
But when you say it's got to be bipartisan and there's that agreement, but is it a gas tax increase? Is it a combination of things?
It's a combination of fees and a gas tax because we've made the gas tax, right or wrong, the main funder of our roads and bridges. But remember, you know, if you didn't do anything, adjusted for what's occurred with the CAFE regulations, which are the regulations that have now made our cars more fuel efficient.
Right.
We've seen a decrease in revenue, not adjusted for inflation. We've gone from almost $2 billion a year for roads and bridges now to $1.3 billion coming in on the gas tax because of things like electric cars, fuel efficient. You'll look around and you'll see the Ozinga family red and white cement trucks. Look closer down here when you see them. You'll see the tanks on the side.
Right.
They're running on natural gas. They don't pay for the roads and bridges now.
Right. But I mean, we also have to be more technology smart here in this era on making that assessment more broad-based.
Sure. I mean, this is a user fee. It's got to be user-based. There are a lot of things. There's vehicle miles traveled. There's being experimented with around the country.
Well, remember, that was a boogeyman,
though.
It's
a boogeyman because people are afraid that there's going to be a transponder in my car.
Big government
even
is
though
tracking
we walk around
you.
With smartphones in our pocket that tell more about us to strangers than anything you'd ever see in a transponder for vehicle miles traveled.
I mean, I do think there has to be that adjustment because, yeah, we're victims of our own success in some respect.
Absolutely.
With the more miles per gallon, those kinds of things, more fuel efficiency, but there's still that price to pay. Plus, you know, as you said, it's in roads and bridges, obviously. Well, but I mean, you look at the whole transportation segment of Metra and you know the needs of Metra's capital program. I mean, you know, talk to Kirk Dillard.
Absolutely, right.
That is a crucial part of the transportation component because that's people that aren't on the roads then.
Well, any of the funding that we raise through the gas tax and these fees, 20% goes to our mass transit, our buses and our rail, which need a major investment as well. When I speak of roads and bridges, I'm also speaking of transportation with buses and rail and the allocation that goes to that from that fund.
Now, you say you think it should happen quickly.
It has to happen. And in the talks we've had with leadership, they understand it, and they're all pushing in the same direction. And I believe the governor believes in this as well. It's a bit of a timing issue when they have the priorities of the things they're trying to get through. But I think this drives it home. Remember, we have 2,300 delinquent bridges in this state that are in failing or poor condition.
I just wonder how quickly it does happen, because, you know, obviously, as you said, gas tax, whatever, there's the political game to this, where there's the reality that we've been talking about, but then right. There's the political.
Well, we're going to be making and rolling out, it starts tomorrow, a major campaign on network news and social media on the need for the replacement of our infrastructure and the need for a transit fix, so that being a transit bill that'll pay for our roads and bridges and transit. That rolls out tomorrow. It'll be ourselves and our partners in the industry that are going to try to point out what needs to be done.
I just see this at the end as one of the last things that they do in the General Assembly in the spring session. Because
have faith.
I don't have faith. I've been covering them for more than 30 years. I see. Yeah. What I see is that this becomes where you need you.
Rick, I came to the WGN studios today, and I saw a White Sox schedule on the table.
Anything can happen. Have faith. but I see that it gets wrapped into the political game of, okay, you're a legislator. I need your vote for something. You vote for this, you get a bridge. You know that game.
Well, it's not even. There's so many bridges, everybody will get a bridge. They need to be repaired.
There's
no lack of bridges. They got to be fixed.
But I just tend to think that's the part. Because sure. To me, granted, no legislator, nobody likes to vote for a tax increase. But I've always said when it comes to infrastructure, that's perhaps the easiest to explain to your constituents because you actually have something to show for it.
What better time to do it than now? People will be in the next month, 2 months, will be living the reality of the lack of investment over the last 30 years or plus that we have not made in our infrastructure on the roadside, not the bridges side, because these roads are going to explode with potholes. They're going to explode with closures. That frost has gone so deep this year. When it comes out, there'll be hell to pay on our roads and bridges.
And that's your transportation forecast from James Sweeney, the president and business manager of the International Union of Operating Engineers Local 150. Mr. Sweeney, thank you so much for joining me. I hope you'll come back again.
Absolutely, anytime. Thank you.